I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code PLAY100. That's code PLAY100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Wagon Wheel Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Kimber, and this show is part of our Red Inca and YouTube network. On this show, we record weekly with questions from the audience via Spotify Live. This podcast is funded by Patreon, which you can join by clicking a link in the show notes. And there are many other benefits, but one of which is to ask questions first on this show. So yes, let's get on with another Wagon Wheel Podcast here over on Spotify Live. I have my Richie Beno t-shirt on from Bodyline T-Shirts, so that's fun. I do like this one. My son likes this one. He doesn't really know anything about Richie Beno, but he likes the fact that someone got famous for saying, "Morning, everyone." Let's go through the Patreon questions. Will says, "What's the worst Twitter social media outrage cycle you found yourself at the center of? How does it feel to be in the center of a backlash?" Interesting. There's a really weird one that I got involved with that had nothing to do with cricket, where, as some people may know, I once did the cover photo for one of P. Diddy's albums. You can't say that and not fully explain the story, but I'm going to this time. Google it. I did. It's weird. And recently someone did a video essay about that album and they tagged me in it. And I kind of made fun of the fact that I'd been tagged in this video, despite the fact that obviously my album artwork had nothing to do with it. How dare they? And the people involved got very upset because they thought that I was making fun of the creator. I was actually making fun of myself, but they didn't know that. And there was a mass pile-on. And it's one of those things that in my case, because it was so, it wasn't like I was being angry or anything like that. So in my case, it was really interesting to sit there and just be like, if we were all in a room, this in 2 seconds, I'd be able to explain this. And you can't explain it on Twitter. And once you explain it to one person, seven other people are involved. And it became this, you know, huge thing of, and at the end, it didn't matter how many times I apologized for something I didn't do wrong, because they were all furious anyway. It's a really, really interesting place. Someone was telling me recently there was an argument they were watching on Twitter over something, again, not that important, like a bit like the one that I was just talking about. And they were just watching it, just going, if these people were actually able to talk to each other, it wouldn't happen. And I remember the comment sections in the old days. There's some people that I absolutely despised in comment sections of some of the major cricket publications back in the day. And then you meet them and you're just like, this is the person I cared about. This is the person I thought about. And you quickly move on. But you can't really do that in Twitter. It does sort of stick around. And the problem is that even if you're wrong or even if you're right, if you justify or you educate on why you have said the thing you've said, it doesn't matter, because then you have to say it to the next person and the next person. And like, if it's a cycle, it's a cycle, right? It spreads without you. So it's a really weird place to be. I can't think if I'm sure I've been in other ones about cricket, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head. But it is quite a weird societal thing these days. AB said, after 32 overs in the IPL, Narine's economy rate was 5.38. How would you advise batsmen to play him from the other end? Is there a reason batters tend not to go down the pitch for him? He's so difficult to pick up that nullifying the tone would surely help. Okay, so the reason you can't go down the pitch to him, and I believe, I could be wrong on this, I believe he was the first spinner to really work this out, is he bowls at a length where you can't. He's basically bowling fast enough at a length that coming down the wicket doesn't really make sense. Maybe Syed Ajmal might have been another one as well. If you can spin it both ways, that obviously causes big problems to the batters. Even the ability to turn it away a little bit at that speed. And so therefore, you have to sort of play them off the back foot as much as possible, or off the front foot, but knowing that any turn either way can beat you. I'm not sure there's a great way. I've always wondered if bowlers like him, you know, there should not be more cross-battered shots. So specifically, kind of sweeps, but maybe where you come down on the sweep a little bit more. But, you know, having talked to people who've played T20 cricket, they usually say that if a bowler isn't being swept a lot, it's probably because they're not particularly easy to sweep. In his case, I would assume it's the length and the pace, which make it a little bit difficult to sweep. But yeah, as far as playing him, I think what you see with Narine is quite often goes through patches where this happens. And then people start to work him out and edge back up to six and a half runs and over. The only thing I would say is he's going at 5.38. I think he's averaging around 25 to 30. I would think from a tactical point of view, it's probably worth sending up some people to hit out against him. Sadeep said, I recently heard This Can Be Done read in a podcast and was intrigued by the cricket stories fables presented in the book. I also remember an episode of Double Century podcast where we go through one of those. Yeah. I think it would make a great documentary, just this bodyline. Yeah, I think one of the things, and we've seen really good other storytellers in other mediums, in other sports, I should say, tell their sports early stories really well. I think the problem is that cricket's early stories were so incredibly well told early on that they've almost become a bit, I'm trying to think of the right way of putting it, I think a bit cliche, a bit dated, a bit, yeah, we've heard that one before. But the actual stories, I mean, Ted Pooley, and the one that you mentioned is Spofforth and WG Grace. If you go back to one, it might even be the first episode of Double Century, the one on Ted Pooley. That's an incredible story. I don't care if it's about cricket or not. It's just an incredible story. And I think one of the reasons that I did Double Century was I really wanted modern fans to, I didn't want them to have to go and dust off old books. I didn't want them to have to read books by old conservative men as well, because a lot of that early history is told very much from old posh men, especially from England. Yeah, I wanted to tell the stories from other vantage points and to have a look at cricket history from the view of today. But you're right, there should be documentaries. We're still hoping that one day we can turn Double Century into a documentary of sorts, animate the episodes that we have at the moment, obviously go forward and look at more and more episodes. But we're a long way off being doing that. But yeah, the early stories of cricket, because it, you know, I say this all the time, but like W.G. Grace was like famous, I don't know, what, 35, 40 years before the modern Olympics. It was so early. And some of the stuff that went on is crazy. Like the story of the guy who was upset at the chucking and literally gets on his horse and rides off. You know, basketballers and footballers aren't getting on horses and leaving places. You know, with the sort of stories that we have are just incredible in cricket. And I'm with you. I think they should certainly be told more often and better. Nicholas says, what do you think Cricket Australia's end goal with players like Cameron White and Steve Smith were when they were batting at number eight? Well, there's a blast from the past, Nicholas. Do you think they ever considered them to be viable long-term spin options? No, I think they probably thought. I mean, both of them, by the time Cameron White was picked for Australia, his spinning was almost dead. I think they still had some high hopes for Steve Smith's bowling at the time he was picked. But even then, I think they were thinking that if they could get them as, well, in Steve Smith's case, they were thinking he could bat number seven. No one actually thought he could even bat in the top six at that point. And in Cameron White's case, they were thinking if he could bat number six and do the sort of Marcus North role. And to be honest, if you think about it, Nicholas, they had success with Marcus North. So I think that's probably where those ideas came from and how they kind of thought about them why they happened. But they were clutching at straws. I remember telling Marcus North that he had the best figures of any spinner in Sheffieldshire cricket that year. There's absolutely no doubt they saw that and just went, why not? And it's obviously why not was maybe the reason they didn't win that Cardiff test. But yeah, they were certainly struggling back in those days. Rajashi says, you have mentioned that Imran Khan's peak was much better than all others. Probably not than Bradman, but yes. Can I please mention some numbers or stats to back it up? Well, I've done it heaps of times. For a decade, he averaged over 50 with the bat and under 20 with the ball. I'm pausing, so I know a lot of you are listening to this on the audio, but I mean, that's incredible, right? That's another level of performance. And I think you'd have to go through, I'm not sure, it might have been in my Sam Curran video, but I've written about it a few times. I think you could say his batting average was more of a plucky player who was hard to get out rather than a bit like what we've seen from Ravi Jadeja over the last couple of years, rather than a dominant batter. But when you're averaging 50 and you can't go out for a decade, it doesn't matter that you don't make, you know, 100 after 100. And he was so hard to get out and he made so many good scores that backed up Pakistan. And then on the other side of it, he absolutely was still destroying with the ball. He probably wasn't their main striker all the way through that period, but he started off obviously as that bowler and then changed into another bowler, which is we've never seen anyone dominate a decade like that outside of Bradman in the 30s. Although I suppose Bradman never quite did it for a decade because of the war. But the two strongest decades probably are Bradman and then Imran Khan. And the best way to look at it is, if you average over 50, you're considered a great batter. If you average anywhere near 20 with a ball, you're considered a great bowler. And so in his case, he was worth two greats to the team. And I've always said that's basically Bradman as well, right? He's worth two great batters in any team. So yeah, there's the stat to back it up. It's next level, that stat. Ian says, inspired by Stokes' likely appointment, I think since you've sent that message, Ian, he has been appointed. How does captaincy generally affect bowling roles in terms of when, how much, how successfully skippers bowl in comparisons to the pre-captaincy days? We haven't had that many bowling captains in Test cricket. You tend to find these days that most bowling plans are sorted out off the field. And so it's only when things go wrong. There are bowling captains who don't bowl themselves that much, and there are bowling captains who bowl themselves a lot. And so the bowling numbers, generally, when I've looked at them, they don't really sway in either direction. What I would say is, more often than not, when you become captain as a bowler, you're older and you're probably not going to bowl as many overs as you did when you were younger, regardless. So it probably looks like bowling captains slightly bowl less than they should, but that's probably not the case. They're probably just because they're getting into their late 20s, early 30s, or mid 30s in some cases. But yeah, it's certainly something that's it's talked about a lot. But it's a bit like when we looked up batters and captaincy, how much captaincy affects batting. And you're like, when you break it down, you look at everything, it doesn't actually affect captaincy. My guess is it would be almost identical in bowlers, in that you would have a very, very similar situation there. Reggie says, Elon Musk has started to venture into all sorts of things now. He is South African and he's very likely to play some cricket growing up. Could he play in the England top order? Look, I've said for ages that, and I use him as a joke, and I used him as a joke like 10 years ago, well before he was massively famous, but it wouldn't be that hard to basically start a rebel league. And Elon Musk was always my joke, and it got harder to use him as a joke as he got more famous. But the point is that he's a guy we know who is massively into cricket and has lots of money. He could buy cricket and change it like that. I mean, Kerry Packer took over cricket and did Mono. You know, we saw Lalit Modi try and do it. I forget the name, but the ZTV guy. They could have done it easily if they didn't have a falling out. This is the thing. Cricket is not run to make the most money. It's not run as efficiently as it should be made. The players, especially outside of, well, almost everyone outside of the Australian test players really aren't paid the right percentages compared to what, you know, major athletes do in other sports. It makes them all very, very poachable. And I think it was David Warner who talked about when the Rebel League came to him. I think the number they mentioned to him was $50 million. He's not getting that from Cricket Australia, is he? And realistically, that sounds like a huge amount of money, but it's not. Because if you took all of cricket, and no matter how you package it up, it's probably worth between $4 and $8 billion over a, what, 4 to 8 year period. You can pay the top players a lot of money. So yeah, Elon Musk or anyone else could do that realistically. I mean, Elon's probably busy these days buying Twitter for, I don't know why, something to do with free speech, or he's upset that some of his friends are gone. I don't really understand why he bought Twitter.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto renews.
Johnny says, in Amazon's The Test, Payne chooses to bowl at the Oval in the 2019 Ashes. Langer talks about how surprised he was at the decision. The coaches, captains and analysts discuss and agree these decisions beforehand. Surely in any other major sport, top teams would never let a decision like that to be left to one person on his own. I think most major sports probably allow those decisions to be, you know, I mean, if you've got a head coach of a basketball team or an NFL team or a manager in football, I think the buck generally lies with one decision maker. Where cricket is more confusing, Johnny, is that we have multiple. As an analyst, it's very rare I was involved in the toss, but I would usually give the toss stats and give my thoughts beforehand. Coaches are different. Some coaches are very strict on what should be done at the toss. More often than not, though, the captain does have the final say. Unless Payne changed his mind beforehand, the thing that would confuse me about that is that I would have thought he would have told Langer, but I don't know their relationship. I have certainly seen situations where captains and coaches, the coach basically says, it's your toss, you go with it. And there are many other captains and coaches who have far closer relationships. And sometimes, you know, the analyst is involved. Very rare that I'm out on the ground looking at the pitch on match day. But I usually do my research beforehand, look at the numbers, and then talk to the groundskeeper and literally say, you know, what are you thinking here? Tell me a bit about this pitch, and those sorts of things. Satchmo says, on how much captains contribute, I have two examples. Ian Chappell's helping to Australia a world number one, and Ray Illingworth's strategy that helped win the series versus West Indies in 1969. How would you assess these? Well, the first thing that's important is you're talking about cricket when the captain was pretty much the only person. The you know, Warwick Armstrong and Douglas Jardine had huge impacts on their team. That's not captaincy today, Satchmo. That's the most important thing to do that. Ian Chappell helping his team to be number one, I'd have to go back through all the numbers and have a look at that and have a look at the team, have a look who they were going up against and all those sorts of situations. Ray Illingworth's strategy to help them win in 1969. It's the same again, right? And what generally happens is, I'm not having a go at anyone's book or on any of those sorts of situations, but essentially what we tended to do in the history of cricket was give the captain a lot of credit because it was such an all-encompassing job. There were so many different details of it. You were the manager, you were the coach, you were the captain, you were the head strategist, you were the analyst, you were all those sorts of different things. And so when things went wrong, right, we tend to look at the captain. But a lot of that does go back to the early part of cricket, where it was generally a gentleman captain from England. It was their team. Their name was on the team, right? And so we gave them a lot more credit. My guess is that if Ian Chappell helped his team become number one in the world, there might have been a lot of off-field stuff there. But it's also because they had a really good team. Because you don't become number one team in the world unless you have a really good team. And on the Illingworth thing, he needed the players to be able to back that up. I'd have to have a look into it. But it's very interesting that you've looked at two very, very old examples. I think the best modern example is the Brendan McCullum one, of course, which everyone talks about. And the more we learn about what happened in New Zealand cricket, the less it's about Brendan McCullum. Still had a very, very big impact. And you could say that perhaps it couldn't have been done without him, but you could say the same of perhaps someone like Mike Hessing. You could say the same of the first-class cricketers who changed the system. You could say the same of the pitches being changed in New Zealand. We tend to go towards the captain because he's the one diving out on the field or making the emotional speeches, but these things don't happen on their own. Christopher says, a lot of crowds in England have become almost darts-light and have a lot of football chants. It's very loud, booze-heavy. A lot of that isn't relevant to cricket with the chanting. It was prevalent at the 100, in which the ECB wanted to target families, and they obviously limited alcohol sales. My question is, do you think the ECB are okay with this? As attendance-wise, crowds are still going up. First 3 to 4 days are sold out Edgbaston for the India test compared to 4 years ago. Yeah, I think you get this in Australia. You get this with the Big Bash. There are certain crowds at the Big Bash which I found were more lad-heavy, if you will, and there were certain crowds that I found were more family-heavy. Generally, if you've got a whole family going, you then have usually women and men. If you have a whole family going, you then have two different generations. If you have a whole family going, they're not just going to chant. They're probably going for the general experience, which might involve listening to chants, of course. You're building generations. You're building new fans. That's generally what all sporting organizations want. But hardcore fans usually go back to that kind of behavior, whether it's specifically what you're talking about or anything sort of in specific involving that. There's certainly cases where once it goes too far, that seems to be a bigger problem. And also, if you get to a point where families aren't going because of those crowds, that becomes a problem. I would say that's where the ECB is probably more upset, more worried. So the Oval is the one I know the most about. And the big problem with the Oval was that families weren't going to the T20 games as much anymore because it would become just a darts football-like environment. And that's not what the families wanted to take their children to. The 100 was probably a slight step back from that, but it's still going to, the same people who like T20 cricket are still going to come to the 100. But it's making it so that the families still feel there are parts of the ground that they can go to, that there are facilities and all those sorts of things. So I've always thought that the crowd chanting and all that sort of stuff and the drunken atmosphere of English T20 games, it's like, yeah, the biggest problem is you don't have facilities for children. When I try and take a child into the ground, it's a nightmare. That's the biggest problem for those grounds. It's not always the crowd behavior. And if you get fewer families there, what is that going to be made up of? Probably more people who want to drink. So I think the ECB are aware, and all cricket boards are aware, that you know that sort of rowdy fan is going to go to any environment, even in the countries where you don't have drinking at the cricket. But what you have to have is facilities available for families to be able to go. And I think that's the bigger problem. And setting it up so that it's a family day out. Which again, I don't think cricket was doing beforehand in England, certainly. Kennedy says, if I could afford to buy an IPL team, if they do keep getting more expensive, save up, Kennedy. I'd like to be thinking that my first order of business would be to hire you as GM. Done. Should I hire you? How would you go about getting an edge over the other teams? Would Benny Howe play every game? I think you should hire me. I think my pitch with most of the teams that I've talked to is I don't think they're getting the right level of due diligence, which means that they make a lot of decisions based on other people who are already in cricket. I don't think they put enough stock into very simple technology that could actually help their players get better. I don't think they have good enough systems in place to make sure that they're improving their players every single time. I don't think they have good enough systems in place for the off-season when they have those sorts of things. I see you also said, would Benny Howe play every game? He'd probably be in my franchise, if we're being honest, although you know, Dan Weston and I might fight for him. But yes, I've talked to a couple of teams of recent times, two IPL teams, a couple of county teams, and I've shown them what I can do, and they usually look at it as and say, "This, there's too much. You're trying to do too much." I'm like, "This is what a professional sporting club should be doing now," and it's usually too big a jump. So whether I'm the ideal person or whether I'm the person who should just be continuing to put my hand in the ring and eventually find it, I don't know. But it'd be good fun. And I really enjoyed running St. Lucia, and I never got a chance to run them while the tournament was on. Although I almost feel like that's the less important part of a GM. But it would have been great to be able to do that. I think I learned a lot from that job. I've said before, I loved being a GM of a team. I don't think I'm going to get another offer, although you never know. I know I probably will get another offer. That's probably wrong. I may not ever take another offer. It's maybe the better way of putting it. All right, we've got some questions here. All right, first question. You there, Rahul?
Hey, Jared, can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question, mate?
So I was watching yesterday's game between Hyderabad and Gujarat, and I started noticing that in IPL, there's no score big enough in the last two overs to be chased. That's the kind of pattern that's becoming these days. And I was like, yeah, it's okay because it's IPL. As compared to international cricket, in IPL, they've been scoring runs easily, like chasing runs easily in the last two overs. And my first reaction was, yes, as you've also mentioned before, the standard of IPL has gone down. Also, because it's franchise cricket, obviously the standard of cricket would be lesser than international cricket, I'm assuming.
No, it's not lesser than international cricket.
I mean, yeah, so the whole premise was that I was like, why is IPL, like, why are they able to chase scores if there's no score big enough? And you don't see this in international cricket that often.
You don't see as many games of international cricket. We've seen some huge chases in international cricket as well. What did Australia do to Pakistan in the World Cup? And those were on pitches where it was almost impossible to score particularly quickly. So I think what you're seeing here is flat pitches where the ball isn't going soft at the end and teams are doing it. It's all the same players. So I really don't think that there's so few international T20 games, but yeah, no, I definitely think you could see these exact same chases in international cricket. That's you're just seeing a couple of good chases of recent times in the IPL, and you're forgetting how bad the IPL was last year when we played on the worst pitches.
But these pitches, okay, if we just look at the pitches, like I saw yesterday's over by Marco Jensen. Like, the bowling was bad. Like, even I, who's not a bowler, could see that this guy just bowled a full toss. And after that, it's predictable he's going to bowl a short one. And that's exactly what he did. And Ash Khan hit him for 2 sixes in a row. And that's what I've started noticing, that these bowlers are at least trying to give themselves the best chance. And even that is not happening. And that's a pattern that I started noticing in this IPL, at least, that it's exciting that these runs are scored, but it's not fun when you know that, okay, no score is big enough. They're just going to chase it down. So I guess... recency bias, or is it just actually happening?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a look at how many teams have won batting first versus won batting second, but you're saying that, and what I'm seeing is a tournament where everyone's losing wickets at the top. So far, it's been a power play bowling tournament, and you're talking about the other end, so it's really interesting for me that you're focusing on that. Teams can chase between, you know, the West Indies used to make sure that the run rate never got above 10 and over. I think now teams believe between, 14 to 18 and over for 2 or 3 overs is possible. So they've certainly changed their mindsets. But that's not a IPL thing. Like, I've heard everyone in T20 cricket talk about that, including the international teams. So I find it, I'd have to go back through the numbers and have a look, how often teams are doing that. My memory is, and I don't know, up until very recently, it was still like, 51% of teams won batting second and 49% won batting first. And when you listen to other people, everyone seems to think it's like 80% batting second and 20% batting first. You know, there's a reason we haven't got rid of the toss, or we haven't had a look at that, any massive rule changes or playing condition changes there. I don't know. I saw Chennai struggle to get a chase the other day. I mean, I think we've seen a few, haven't we? I wonder if you're just focusing on the couple of times when we've seen teams chase and kind of forgetting about the times when they haven't chased.
Right. As I said, it could be a recency bias as well.
I'd have to have a look through the numbers, mate. But yeah, my thought of this tournament so far is that what we've seen is slightly better pitches for fast bowlers, and they've been dominating at the top. That's been the pattern that I've seen more than anything else in this tournament so far.
Okay. So it's not because of those, because I focused on the first conversation you ever had about this IPL, is that because of 10 teams, the standard is going to go down. And my idea was maybe because of the standard going down, and that is why what I'm noticing is what I'm noticing.
But why would that just be happening in death bowling and it's not happening to the batters? Do you know what I mean? So the standard going down is really, it should be more drop catches. We should be seeing more mismatch cricket where, you know, you see people, who, especially the guys who are batting 5, 6, 7, some of the local players, even some of the overseas players at times where they're coming in and their level is just not quite high enough for this competition, or their level's high enough, but they're not suited to the conditions of the IPL. And we should be seeing players like Shivam Dubey and Deepak Hooda and those sorts of players starring a bit more, because it was such a hyper strong league before. I don't know why that would, like, do you know what I mean? Like, why would that make the batters stronger than the bowlers? There should be a general problem across the board.
You're right about the drop catches. That's definitely has increased.
It seems like it. I haven't looked at the numbers yet, but yeah, it seems like
the tournament, do you still think that the standard has gone down?
Well, the standard's definitely gone down. It was impossible not to. There were some people who were really upset at that piece. And it's like, I'm not saying that the IPL is shit, because before it was 8 teams. You had so few international players playing in it, but the ones who were playing in it were mostly the best players in T20 cricket around the world. You had very few Indian players who weren't either Indian level players or potential Indian level players playing on their sides. Well, now we don't. We've had to get extra players on every team. You know, the international players are thinner and the local players are thinner. It's not like in the space of a year, Indian cricket got 20% more talented, and yet you need 20% more players playing. So I think in the long run, it might mean that it's a more talented league because you give more opportunities to people. But in the short run, it was obviously always going to be a slightly weaker league.
Got it. Thanks a lot, Jared.
Thanks for your question. If you're having trouble getting through, feel free to just add your question on the chat. But I'll try and get to... Well, let's try Nikhil again. Nikhil, you there?
Hey, Jared, can you hear me?
I can this time. What's your question, mate?
All right. So, firstly, good evening, Jared. I just love these. This is my first Spotify Live. I actually struggled to find the damn app. I thought it was Spotify Green Room first.
It was Spotify Green Room. And don't get me started on the fact that they bought an app called Locker Room. They changed it to Spotify Green Room, and now they've changed it to Spotify Live. Just stick with a color frame, stick with a name, and go with it for at least 12 months. Anyway, sorry, mate.
Even 12 days would be. Anyway, yeah. What I have is an interesting question. And I just want, so a lot of people, especially I've been reading in the British newspapers, you know, The Guardian, Telegraph, all of these guys just say that there are no signs of Anderson slowing down. You know, he's still bowling as well as ever. You know, and they point out to his bowling average. It took me back to when Ishan Sharma was dropped from the Indian team. It's probably for good now. But his stats over the last 2 or 3 years are fairly good. You know, it's still like 29 or 27 bowling average. Even Anderson's bowling average was excellent. But I think what people are failing to understand that just like they judge batsmen through averages, they judge bowlers through averages as well. Whereas actually, what they should judge Anderson and maybe, you know, even guys like Ishan Sharma by is their strike rate. Because a batsman, if he plays a shit shot, he gets out and that's it. You know, that sort of ruins his tangible stats. Whereas a bowler like Anderson, his strike rate was 80 with the ball in the Ashes, right? So he's not really troubling Australia's batsman. He might come in, he might go at 2 and over and he might end up with, you know, stats like 3 for 60 in 28 overs. But that's not going to hurt Australia because...
But that's what he's always done. What you're talking about is not a new thing for him. That's what he's always done. He's never been a great strike rate bowler, especially outside of England. I think where your logic slightly falls down is that when you're talking about Ishan having a bowling average of 28 or 29 over the last couple of years, it was 20. So over the last handful of tests, he's ballooned. Anderson hasn't had that ballooning yet. And even in Australia, where he wasn't bowling his best, he still was getting regular wickets and he was still actually keeping that record down. You make a very good argument that Anderson may not help England into the future because he's never been able to take more than 3.2 wickets a test away from home. I think that's a very, very solid argument with Anderson. Where I don't think you make that argument is that there's any massive sign of decay. So the only sign of decay we could find was that he stopped taking wickets in the fourth innings. I think it was the fourth innings.
Or even the second innings in a match. Even the third innings in a match.
I think the third innings was fine. I think it was the fourth innings. I think I'm right in saying that. I'll have to go back and have a look at that. But when you looked at the numbers, it was like, when you looked at the control numbers, it just looked like bad luck, right? It didn't look like it had anything to do with fitness or injury or anything like that. I think with Ishan Sharma, And I'm not sure that they were right to get rid of him, but they had a bunch of other bowlers they thought could replicate what he was doing. And it was notable that he wasn't bowling the same way that he had when he was, for a long time, probably the best bowler in the world, right? There's no way of looking at Anderson and thinking he's dropped off, and his numbers haven't specifically dropped off. And, you know, unless you say he dropped off in Australia, but he always drops off.
Has he become better as a bowler, as some people say? I don't think he's become better as a bowler, right?
What do you mean? Like, of recent times?
Yeah, in recent times. So his average has come down, but his strike rate, because the economy rate has gone down, but his strike rate has gone up at the same time. And therefore, I'm not sure. I mean, how do you look at it? You know, for a test match bowler, is strike rate as important, especially for the opening bowler, is the strike rate as important as your average?
No. Average is always way more important. There's a problem with that. Most of the best bowlers who have very low strike rates, most of the average bowlers who have very low strike rates, they don't help the bowler at the other end. So if you're bowling with Anderson, he's completely controlling one end and is going to be taking wickets. Whereas if you're bowling with Stephen Finn, he's going at 4 runs and over and you can't put pressure on at the other end. And if he's not actually taking a wicket at that time, you don't get anything out of it. There are no bad bowlers with low averages. There are more bowlers with lowish strike rates overall who are not particularly good bowlers, right? So, I mean, I wouldn't worry about that too much, but that's also, most bowlers don't have incredibly low strike rates. There's only a handful ever. There's, you know, you've got your Abadas and your Steins. Both of them play in South Africa. The wickets fall more often. Most Australian bowlers don't have low strike rates because it takes a long time to get wickets in Australia. So I'm not too worried about that. What I'd be more worried about is if I was watching him and it looked like there was noticeable signs of a problem and that was being matched up with his average, then I've got no problem with them moving on from him if he's no longer at the top of his game. But I haven't seen that.
One last point, 30 seconds more. Because this took me back to when I look at batsmen who've been dropped after playing a sizable amount of tests. You know, I'm just taking the example of Ian Benn or Ajinkya Rahane. You know, there has been a large variance in their average from their peak or to what it's ended up at. You know, 4 or 5 runs drop off. But you don't see that with bowlers. Is that because bowlers just get dropped more quickly than batters? Or
yep.
Bowlers might be like out of form. They may not be impacting the team as much, but still, they might end up with figures like, say, 2 for 60, which doesn't affect their average as much as it shows. I mean, their impact is still lower, but because they can always end up with a few cheap wickets at the end of the innings, they still sort of maintain the average, even though their impact is lower for the team. Because I never see a bowler whose average is 23 after 60 tests, and then it goes up to 29 after like 80 tests or 85 tests. Like Gahane's has, for example, from 43 to 38.
Yeah, no, because they get dropped straight away. There's two reasons for this. One is the batters run the game more often than not. And the way that we look at bowling is usually incorrect. The second is that a bowling unit is usually 4 players, right?
So there's less room for error. There's less room for MET.
Batting unit is at least 6, maybe 7, maybe 8, you know, maybe 9. So you can stuff up for a while. Also, we know that batting, I mean, you know, look at Virat Kohli at the moment. Look at Greg Chappell back in the day. We know that batters can go duck, 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 duck because they could just get a bunch of bad decisions. They could run themselves out a couple of times. They could go out very early on. If you go 5 tests without taking, you know, more than 5 wickets as a bowler, my guess is that you're probably going to get dropped almost no matter how good you are, right? At the very least, you'd be rested and they, you know, want, if it was a physical thing and if it's not a physical thing, I mean, Gillespie probably only played 2 extra series than he should have. And he's an Australian great bowler, right? And he still only got 2 extra series. If he was a batter, how many extra series would he have got, honestly? 7, 8, 9, you know? Ponting's book is really interesting. I was saying that Ponting was finished a long way out and it did not go down well. And in Ponting's book, he admits it. He admits almost from the point of which I thought there was a problem. He said, looking back, I should have left the team. And they just kept playing him. And, you know, if that was a bowler, you couldn't hide what was going on with Ponting if he was a bowler. So I think as a batter, I think they felt like, oh, he'll come good. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of batters who play on well beyond their best. And with bowlers, it's just harder. It's just a smaller team when it comes to that. Thanks for your question though, mate.
Thank you so much.
Oh, sorry. James, who I think can't talk. Sometimes it feels like my 10-year-old could get Aaron Finch out any day except the one day he made 150 against England. Yeah, I think with Aaron Finch, it really depends on what day you're seeing him. He's very much a, he's a player that for about a month, you can't, no one can dismiss. He's got, weirdly enough, I mean, he always used to nick off to balls outside off stump a lot. Then he developed a new problem with the LBW and the bolds with his front pad. He's always, I don't know, what's on the verge of another technical flaw. And he does have a lot of technical flaws. That's why he doesn't make a lot of red ball runs. But also because of the way he plays and the way he can play on the up, there's almost a bit of Virat Kohli to his batting in a way. It's very hard to bowl a good length to him. So when you can't bowl that good length to him, and he's just going to drive them anywhere he wants, and also just smash them over the leg side if he needs to, it means that on his best day, there's not a lot you can do to him. But on his worst days, there's so many different ways you can dismiss him. I think, you know, he's just one of those players. He's a very flawed player who worked out by being very smart the best way to be successful in white ball cricket. And more often than not, the game of white ball cricket is in your favour. And I think that's why, and you know, I've been watching him since he was very young. I never thought he'd make any runs in red ball cricket. I thought it was astonishing that Australia picked him in the test matches. But they did, partly based on his attitude and his mindset. And they thought it would come good, but it didn't. And you know, I don't think there's ever been a player who has not consistently made runs in first-class cricket who can make runs consistently in test cricket. Even guys like Vaughan and Triscothic, you hear about, they had made runs consistently in red ball cricket before. Picking a white ball hitter doesn't necessarily work. And I think in Finch's case, he would have needed to have been in the absolute best form of his life, and he probably could have got away with about 10 tests. And I think the next 10 tests, he would have struggled because we've seen that pattern from him over and over again in cricket. But he still is an incredible player, and he's very difficult to bowl to, I think. All right, who else is in the chat? Arnav.
Hi, Jared. I wanted to ask about two batsmen. One is David Martin, and second is Graham Thorpe. I believe both of them are pretty underrated. I mean, if without Martin, I don't think Australia, that great team, would have won in 2004. And I saw his stats. He has scored runs all across the globe and in tough situations. But I think so, his batting average, that 45-46 in that great batting period, I think so, that do you think that is one reason he's not being talked in that great category?
Well, he's not being talked in that great category because Australia had about four players who were better than him.
No, but if you see his variety and range.
Yeah, no, he was a magnificent player. But was he better than Ponty?
I mean, in subcontinent, yes, but not in Australia, South Africa, right, and England.
Was he better than Hayden?
No, not even Hayden.
Was he better than Steve Waugh?
No.
Do you see what I'm saying? Was he better than Gilchrist? I know he ended up with a similar record and Gilchrist scored twice as quick as him, right? So what you're looking at there is there's a lot of old England teams with great batting lineups too, where the fourth best batter was incredible, but it doesn't matter because they had a bunch of players who were better than him. Also, it is very much worth remembering that he didn't make it when he was young. So he's slightly older than Ponting, right? Ponting had to fight through that era and learn his game at the test level. I think that Damien Martin came back when he was ready. If Damien Martin had played the whole time at Test cricket, he probably has a much more similar record to maybe someone like Mark Waugh, which is fine. I mean, you know, Mark Waugh should have averaged more as well. But he didn't really have to fight through those trickier bits because he was dropped and because he couldn't, you know, he was dropped from the Western Australian team. So I think that plays part of it. But if you look at the players sort of before and after him, I think it has more to do with the fact that he was probably never in the top three batters in any of those Australian sides, despite the fact he was fantastic at times. And, you know, there were certainly a couple of years where he was incredible. He was, though, he did get batches of runs. Weirdly, going back to Aaron Finch, he was a little bit similar to Aaron Finch. He would get very, very big batches of runs and then obviously go missing as well. I think if Damien Martin has a very big 2005 Ashes, things are a little bit different. There's also the fact that he quit midway through a series in quite dramatic circumstances. There's also what happened with him early in his career. I think there's a few caveats with Damien Martin. I think if you watch him play, and if you ever watch any highlights of him, you would unquestionably say, how is this guy not one of the greats of batting? But at the end of his career, he probably ended up with a very similar record to VVS Laxman, I would have thought. And very similar players in some ways. I know VVS sort of batted longer, whereas Martin's runs came in a batch, but very similar in that they were just better players in their team. But when you watch them, they often look like the best player, but they weren't consistently game after game. I love watching Damian Martin, but Michael Clarke was probably a better bat than him again. We haven't even mentioned him from before. So there were so many players that overlapped with him that were as good, if not better. And I think that's probably the main reason he doesn't get remembered massively.
About Grant, now bad English batsmen last 20 years, people say syndrome.
Sorry, mate, I'm just going to have to remove you because your call's gone all weird in my ears. If you ask about Graham Thorpe, yes, I think Graham Thorpe's probably his biggest problem was he never quite dominated at the level that he needed to. Him and Alex Stewart probably, if you look at just their batting numbers alone, deserve more credit, but they played in losing teams. They're remembered for, you know, going out at key moments, which there's nothing you can do if your team isn't as good as the opposition. Graham Thorpe also just left before the 2005 Ashes. If he plays in that series, let's say he has a very good series there and England still win. Maybe that's more of a crowning achievement in Graham Thorpe's career. But you're right, I think he's a fantastic player as well. But again, he doesn't have that great average that makes it automatic. But I think if you look between Graham Gooch and Alistair Cook, Alex Stewart's probably the only other batter that was really in that level. It just happened to be that's a terrible level. That was a terrible time for English cricket. And they were known as being kind of terrible. And I think that probably rubbed off onto Graham Thorpe a little bit as well. But he played some brilliant innings. He was a magnificent player. No doubt about that. Bamshi, you there?
Hey, Jared, how are you doing?
I'm very good. Loving the bow tie. What's your question?
Thanks. My question is about the 2010-11 Ashes versus England. Mm-hmm. I know they had a really, really good batting lineup and a pretty decent attack with Swan and then Breston to give you a fifth bowler. What would you say are the major reasons why England haven't been able to replicate those kind of things? I know there's been a decline in batting skill in England, but after 2010, none of their series have been compelling. So that one really special for them.
I mean, Swan had a functioning elbow. So next time he went back, he didn't have a functioning elbow, which meant he had the ability to stop the Australians from scoring heavily in the middle. I think that was really, really important. I think Tremlett was, you know, that was probably the only, it was probably that in that series against India that we ever saw Tremlett anywhere near at his best. And I think he was much better in that series against Australia. I think Australia played really poorly. They completely overestimated their side. I think they underestimated England. They didn't plan as well as England did. That was maybe one of the last major series Australia ever played where I think you could say that they just weren't thinking about it. I've got a feeling that they named a squad of like 20 people or something coming into that series. And then the Australian batters tired out their bowlers. The England bowlers tired out the Australian batters massively. Started at the Gabba and then they did the same thing at Adelaide. And then it's funny, I was talking to Matt Pryor about this when we were on TalkSport recently, of they couldn't believe how bad Australia batted in Melbourne in that match, because the series was 1-1 at that point. Australia tried to drive everything on the first morning, and it's like, Dean Jones, I used to make fun of Dean Jones for writing the same column every year, don't drive to the MCG on the first day unless you're in a bus. And, you know, they all were driving on the up. Breslin didn't even bowl particularly well. But yeah, so I think it really was a combination of a few different things there. But I do think the Australian bowlers just got very, very tired because of the English batters. And I think the combination of Tremlett, Anderson, Swan, Breslin in really good form, Stephen Finn even took a few wickets to start the series as well, if I remember correctly. It was very clear very early on that they had a lot of bowlers in either career best form or near career best form. And they had the batters to be able to bat very, very long periods of time. And I'm, you know, going back, Australia didn't really have either of those things. You know, they really just didn't, they weren't a very strong team at that particular point. And I'm not sure they knew what their best team was as well. They were still holding on to Ponting. And I just said that Ponting has admitted in his book, I think by that point he was finished. Was it Katic they let go of for that series, I think? Because they didn't want three batters over the age of 35. Hussey had been in terrible form, but found form. It was Kadich and Hussey were probably the two that you wanted to go into that series. They were never going to do that. So they were always going to drop one of Kadich and Hussey, when realistically the person to drop was Ponting. You know, they didn't have very strong bowling. They didn't really understand. I mean, you know, the Xavier Doherty thing, the Michael Beer thing shows that they weren't really thinking about cricket very clearly at that point. And, you know, Mitchell Johnson won them one test on a whim, really. And, you know, at the press conference afterwards, I don't bet on cricket, but if I would have bet on cricket, I would have bet on England to win 3-1. And I might have written about that or put it in a video or something at the time. Because at the press conference afterwards, Mitchell Johnson admitted he didn't know how he took all those wickets. It was such a fluke win. So that was their only win in that series. So I just think a lot of things went right for England and a lot of things went wrong for Australia. But I do think England taught Australia a lesson in preparing for major series, which they, since Buchanan left especially, don't think they'd really been thinking very smart about cricket at that point.
Great. Thank you, Dave.
No worries. Thanks for the question. Dhruv, are you there, Dhruv?
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
And do you think Josh Butler's recent form in the IPL warrants him coming back in test school?
No. I don't think anyone's form in the IPL warrants them playing a test match. They're two different things. Josh Butler is one of the greatest white ball players we've ever seen. The numbers back it up. Our eye test backs it up. This series, I actually think he'd underperformed in the IPL until recently.
So, I mean, since Newton struggled to get wins, he's had like third highest strike rate after Root and Stokes, so.
Third highest average, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he still averages 32.
That is better than Johnny Bairstow, though, so.
Yep. Johnny Bairstow averages 29. It's not much in it, right? So, but your question wasn't, should Butler be in the team? Your question was, should Butler be in the team because of his IPL form? Those are two different questions. The problem with Butler is, we've seen peak Butler in Test cricket. I don't think we're ever going to see better than what we've ever seen. And he can only really bat at number six or number seven, which causes massive problems because their problems aren't at number six and number seven. The problems are at number, well, openers and three and five and six. And they, you know, it's everywhere, right? And Butler doesn't solve any problems. So when Butler came back, they actually added an extra problem to their team that they didn't need. Now, there are two ways of looking at it. You could say that Johnny Bairstow's problems are largely technical and that teams had worked him out. I think I could agree with that. But you can't also deny the fact that they had one of the better wicketkeeper batters in the world in Johnny Bairstow. They brought back a specialist number seven batter who averages three more runs than him, who can't bat as high as him in the order, who isn't a better wicketkeeper, and they eventually gave the gloves to him, ruining Johnny Bairstow's confidence. Now, let's say it is a technical problem for Johnny Bairstow. Still needs his confidence. If you've got a technical problem, you need confidence even more. They absolutely shattered a quality test match player to upgrade it by an average of three and downgrade it when it came to wicketkeeping skill, right? I don't understand their decision. I've never understood the decision. I think it's fair to say, I mean, based on what you've just said, I think their top seven would be Root, Stokes, Butler, Burns, Denley, and Bairstow. Like, if we're talking about the top seven best batting averages, they've already tried all that, right? What is Butler going to give them other than a middling 30s average? He doesn't strike particularly quick. He doesn't take the initiative away from other teams. His strike rate is basically the same as Bairstow's. I don't really get it. I don't understand what they're getting from having Butler that they would get from not having Butler at this point. Does that make sense? Nope. I think he's gone. I hope that made sense. With Umar Malik taking the IPL by storm, Sunil Gavaskar's comments about him only being the fastest in the modern era. Do you think players are actually faster before? The Siddharth said this in the chat. Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, there's no way that Umar Malik isn't the most consistently quick Indian bowler. There might have been Indian bowlers who've had individual balls quicker than Umar Malik, but no. This whole thing that bowlers used to be faster in the older days, we had a speed test in the late 1970s, early 1980s. In that speed test, we saw that Geoff Thompson was 10 kilometers an hour quicker than anyone else. No one else was even close to Geoff Thompson. So if Geoff Thompson was a freak and was so much quicker than anyone else, you know, a Bob Beamon type figure, fine. Let's go with that. I'm happy to go with that. But why was everyone else 10K an hour slower than him, right? So even if he was 100 miles per hour, right, even if he was that speed and he was tested at 152 and that speed test was highly flawed compared to what we use now, but no one else was even close to him. Where are all the other bowlers? There were bowlers who were 25 and 30 kilometers slower than Geoff Thompson in that bowling speed test, all right? So we know that bowling is much quicker now, and that we have, so if you had the fastest bowler in the world now, there's no way they would be 10 kilometers quicker than anyone else. And that's the same in Sean Tate's era, in Shoaib Akhtar's era, and Brett Lee's era, all the way back to Tomo. You would never have that gap that wide. So we know that fast bowlers are quicker than ever before, right? It's undeniable at this point. Just going to see if there's anyone else who's come through. Vamshi's going to have the last question.
Hey, Jared, can you hear me?
I can. Yeah, what was your question, mate?
So you've talked about how analysis and footage has helped bowlers more than batsmen. Is there a reason, apart from that bowlers make the play and they start basically the game of cricket, and is that why analysis has helped them more than batters? Do you see anything happening in the future that could help batters improve?
I think the biggest problem is that most of the footage we have of cricket is from behind the bowler's arm, because that's where we film everything from. If I was working with the team today, someone was asking, it was a Kennedy asked about the general, you know, me being general manager. Every time I've talked to a team, I'm like, the first thing you need to do is get a long lens camera at each end of the ground and film every opposition bowler from front on, right? That's what your batters need to see. They don't need to see the back of them running in. That doesn't help them particularly much. The second thing is that the cameras then have to be very close to these bowlers. We have to get as much information as possible on them, whether that be through long lens or super slow-mo or however that works, so that we can see exactly what they are doing. Then we can start to break down bowlers better. I'm trying to think, there's the super slow-mo cameras that are obviously coming through. They might help batters a little bit more. And then the other thing is probably what we've started doing now, which is being able to say to someone in, so I wonder, in baseball it works because baseball is very much like the death, right? And I wonder if it works more at the death than anywhere else in cricket, where, and which is why we might see some of the big scores that someone was asking about before at the death, I'm not sure. But if there's a possibility of, most bowlers only have like three deliveries at the death, if that makes sense, or three lengths or three lines or whatever it may be, that most bowlers don't have multiple options at the death. And so we should be able to give a batter a lot of information of what the three balls are going to be that you're most likely to face, so that beforehand they can plan that. In test cricket, we know it's only one ball and that doesn't matter. So I don't know. My guess is that if you look at test cricket where the bowlers are really dominating, I wonder how much of it is that maybe there is a way of working out the wobble ball. I don't know if there is, but maybe there is a way of working out the wobble ball. And if that's the case, then analysis is probably our best bet, or a genius player working it out on their own. But yeah, I think the most important thing is get the cameras in front of the bowlers, get it so that you can see their hands better. And that would completely even the playing field, I would have thought. Maybe not even the playing field. That would help you have a huge advantage over bowlers that batters currently don't have.
Great. Thanks, Jared.
No worries. Thanks to everyone. Sorry about the many, many technical problems. Our ghost caller and poor, who was it? Arnav's poor mangled line and some of the muted guys early on. But again, thanks to everyone for popping into this Spotify Live. Remember, you can follow me on Spotify Live. Then you get told about whenever these podcasts come up. Talk to you again next time. Bye. Thanks for listening to Wagon Wheel. And if you have listened this long, you probably like what we do, and that is great. So please rush over and support us on Patreon, which has many extra advantages the podcast doesn't have, like asking earlier questions. And if you want more content, well, I have good news for you, because we have a lot of things. You can follow us on YouTube, where we make all kind of crazy stuff, like complete history of New Zealand opening batters and how Kagiso Rabada was dismissed from a zombie ball. We do a similar thing on TikTok. I also have an emailer that sends out a couple of columns a week, and we run another podcast called Double Century on the History of Cricket. Red Inca is made by me, Jared Kimber. Nick McCorriston is our sound maestro. Mukundra Bandreddy presses record on the videos and then falls asleep. Orajossi Sempati makes the podcast into video gold. and Shubhankar Bhattacharya makes pretty, pretty graphics.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.